forward on her chair with renewed zeal for her occupation, as if another patient weary of her obtuse observations has reported her to some board, and she's trying to avoid additional complaints. Or maybe she's finally cleared whatever hurdle of ambivalence was blocking her getting involved. In any case, great time to come alive, Jenny. I don't want to answer her question, or maybe I don't know how. How was my week? The visit to the vet was irritating. Not knowing the difference between a straight bar and a gay bar was humiliating. My mouth is empty of adjectives and qualifying words, so I relent and swallow and sigh and tell her something else. I might as well fill you in on our visitor. When you say our, Jenny pauses. This is the kind of thing she never would have questioned in previous sessions. She would have figured it out contextually, or just not have been invested enough to care. This is an entirely new Jenny, and I don't like her. Lily and me, and mine, the proper syntax eludes me. You and Lily, okay, proceed. Proceed. Oh, goody, may I? Jenny licks her upper lip, hungry for more of the story. Lily and I have an octopus. I pause for dramatic effect, but only get a confused stare. Then I launch into the whole ordeal, like I did for Trent, like I did for Doogie. It's already becoming like the package of stories I have pre-selected to recount on dates. I bore myself in the telling. Jenny nods as she listens, and her eye contact is unwavering. I almost don't know who this woman is that I'm pouring my heart out to. Seriously, her scrutiny is unnerving. And when you say octopus, you mean... octopus. When I say we, I mean Lily and me, and when I say octopus, I mean octopus. Jenny still looks uncertain, so I pull out my phone and show her the picture of Lily and me with the lay. Look, right here. Except now it's bigger and more prominent and angry. Jenny studies the photo and uses her fingers to zoom in on the octopus. This in itself enrages me, even though I did the same thing. Like she's saying I'm making mountains out of molehills, that I have now been living a week and a day on the edge of hysteria for nothing. Plus, I just told her it was bigger now, meaner. When she looks up, there's something akin to pity in her eyes. Something more than a sorrowful understanding, yet shy of commiseration. But I don't want her pity, or whatever is pity-adjacent. I don't need it. I am going to fix this. I am going to prevail over the octopus. I don't want this look. Jenny hands me back my phone. Have you been to the veterinarian? Duh. On Monday. What did she say? Jenny does this thing where she defaults to the feminine pronoun to make some sort of point about a male-dominated society, something she probably picked up in a women's studies class in the late 90s, and that now feels woeful and stilted. He, I emphasize the he, couldn't say much of anything. He took a few cells to run some tests, and the tests were inconclusive. Now they want to put Lily under anesthesia and take a larger sample. How do you feel about that? When I don't want to answer the question someone asks, I just give the answer to another unasked question. I realize in this moment that I do this a lot. I find myself leaving her alone for short periods. I don't want to be apart from her, but to be with her means I also have to be with him. I pause, and Jenny nods. Plus, the octopus came when I wasn't there, and there's part of me that thinks I need to be gone for him to leave. Maybe the octopus isn't going to leave. My answer to that is a glare. Maybe the octopus isn't going to leave, and what you're doing is emotionally detaching from Lily. My stomach turns. That's offensive. You're being offensive. I'm not meaning to be. It's a natural reaction to grief. Grief? I say it with three question marks, as the word catches me by surprise. What are you talking about? I'm not grieving. Jenny raises an eyebrow as if to say, aren't you? Grieving what? I'm fully focused on forcing the octopus to leave.
Why can't you do both? She asks.
Look who showed up to play. Jenny continues,
why can't you focus on getting the octopus to leave and prepare yourself for the possibility that he may not?
He will leave.
I'll leave that for you and the vet to say. But Lily is older, and you've said yourself that she was the runt of her litter, and her health has at times been tenuous. Unless something catastrophic happens to you in the near future, in all likelihood, she is going to predecease you, and in the greater context of your life, relatively soon. If it's not the octopus that takes her, something else will eventually. A rhinoceros, or a giraffe.
A rhinoceros or a how would a dog have a giraffe?
New Jenny has gone completely around the bend. It's natural as our loved ones age to start grieving their loss, even before we lose them.
I run her words by my imaginary therapist, the one who I count on to take Jenny's bungled advice and turn it into something less botched. He's strangely silent for once.
I'm afraid it means he finds nothing wrong with her diagnosis.
What is grief, anyhow? What does it even mean?
I'm being obstinate. People describe it in different ways.
I'd say it's a temporary derangement. Freud put it as something like a departure from the normal attitude toward life. I stare Jenny square in the eyes so she can see my annoyance. One, my questions were rhetorical. I know what grief is. Two, thank you for calling me deranged.
Jenny smiles as if to soften her insult. Grief is a pathological condition. It's just that so many of us go through it in life that we never think to treat it as such. We just expect people to go through it, endure it, and come out the other side.
The sun pours through the window and lands in a puddle just beyond Jenny's feet. She kicks off her shoes and stretches her naked toes into the sunlight. It reminds me of Lily, who makes a cat-like effort to find whatever sun she can to nap in. It's not uncommon for me to find her with just her hind legs resting in her bed, the rest of her body stretched across the sun-warmed linoleum. I think of the Valium and Vicodin that have sometimes been my sunshine, my desire to crawl into their warming rays. Fine, I'm grieving. Maybe you can write me a prescription. Unfortunately, Jenny knows my fears about addiction. We've covered that topic exhaustively. And doesn't bite.
We'll see.
Maybe I, too, am suffering impairment from the presence of the octopus. Seizures in reason. My thoughts of late have resembled those of a small child more than the thinking of a grown man. The magical rationalization of needing to be gone so the octopus can leave. My desire to be intimidating, bigger than I am, to have the hurricane in me, the need to express everything in a tantrum.
What do you think of when you think of mourning? Jenny asks.
The question snaps me back to attention. I answer without really thinking. I guess Funeral Blues by W.H. Auden. I think it was Auden. I suppose that's not very original.
I don't know it.
It's a poem. I gathered. I'm just clarifying. It's not a blues album. Jenny ignores my swipe at her intelligence.
Does your response need to be original?
Isn't that what poetry is for? For the poet to express something so personal that it ultimately is universal?
I shrug.
Who is Jenny, even new Jenny, to say what poetry is for? Who am I, for that matter?
Why do you think of that poem in particular?
Stop all the clocks, cut off the telephone, prevent the dog from barking with a juicy bone. Silence the pianos, and with muffled drum, bring out the coffin, let the mourners come. I learned the poem in college, and it stuck.
Jenny savors these words like she's testing a bottle of wine before saying, "Not inappropriate." And this is where old Jenny returns. This is where her observations are all wrong. This is where she's a nightmare as a therapist. It is inappropriate. It does not fit the situation or merit consideration in the context of our discussion, mostly for one glaring reason. Prevent the dog from barking with a juicy bone. I can feel another tantrum rising inside me. It's inappropriate if it's the dog you are mourning. Sunday. The frozen turkey lands with a thud in the sink, and it startles Lily awake.
Keep it down! Jeez!
Lily hates to be interrupted from a good nap. I hadn't intended to buy a frozen turkey, or a turkey at all, for that matter. But it's hard to find a fresh turkey in June, and I was desperate to prove I'm not grieving. What better way to demonstrate I'm not suffering a pathological condition than to throw a celebration, in particular, a celebration for everything we have to be thankful for? And nothing accompanies the giving of thanks better than turkey, and stuffing, and gravy, and mashed potatoes, and squash. It wasn't until checking out at the grocery store and the looks I got from the cashier that I realized that cooking a full Thanksgiving dinner in June was in fact its own form of derangement.
Is that tofurkey?
Lily has risen from her bed and sits at my feet by the sink.
Yes, it is. We're having tofurkey.
Years ago, I flirted with vegetarianism, and one year went so far as to make a Thanksgiving tofurkey. When Lily asked for turkey, I told her we didn't have any turkey, but that we had tofurkey. And when I gave it to her, she gobbled it up just the same. The gravy wasn't quite vegetarian, and her feelings pretty much fell in line with mine. Smother anything in enough stuffing, potato, butter, and gravy, and it's pretty damn good. Since then, she's called all turkey tofurkey, and the way she says it is so unbearably cute, I haven't had the heart to correct her.
Tonight, we are going to feast. Oh, boy! Tofurkey is my absolute favorite! I could eat all of the tofurkeys! Just gobble them up!
Lily is now fully awake. She places a paw on my foot. If I can only figure out how to defrost this motherfucker. The turkey just about fills the sink. Lily gives the microwave a sideways glance, and I get as far as trying to shove the damn thing in before realizing there's no way an 18-pound turkey is going to fit in a standard convection microwave.
Or we can eat it frozen like ice cream!
Tofurkey is not good frozen like ice cream. I look down at Lily, who looks up at me. She's anxious for me to fix this. Warm water bath it is. Lily starts to retreat.
For the tofurkey,
I tell her. Not for you. She immediately comes back.
Yes! Do it!
I slide the drain cover under the turkey and fill the sink with warm water. I have a Cook's Illustrated magazine with an article entitled Roasting the Big One, and I find it among a stack of never-read cookbooks. I don't know why I have saved this, but the title has been responsible for several fits of adolescent giggles. While the turkey defrosts, Lily and I set the table. As a kid, I was always enchanted by the holiday tables my mother would set. How she had special tablecloths for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And how there was white china rimmed with gold that would magically appear in November. The budding homosexual in me would study the plates, turning them over and drinking in words like Wedgwood and bone and England. One year my mother even provided glass finger bowls on their own saucers, and Meredith and I dipped our fingers in them after the meal and before the dessert course. It all seemed so elegant to me. I wondered if we didn't secretly descend from royalty on my mother's side. I tried to coax her with my eyes to share with me our closet lineage. I could be trusted to keep the secret safe if we were, in fact, in hiding from some evil czar or queen. But she never did. I remember thinking this is how I was going to eat every night when I was grown up. Of course, even though I inherited my aunt's set of china after she passed away, this is rarely how I eat.
Our Thanksgivings usually consist of Lily sitting by my seat at the head of the table, anxiously licking her chops. Only when the humans have gorged themselves on seconds, and sometimes thirds, is she allowed her holiday meal, served in her supper dish on the kitchen floor. I always crouch beside her, holding her ears back and out of the way, like a supportive college boyfriend holding back the hair of his vomiting sorority girl. It's my favorite part of the holidays, if not the entire year. It's almost like I can absorb the pure joy she radiates. This time, I pick her supper dish off the floor and set her a place at the table. The silverware and cloth napkin at her place setting will go untouched, but they bring symmetry to our table.
Do you remember our first Thanksgiving together? I ask Lily.
Did we have tofurkey?
Lily asks. You, in fact, had a lot of tofurkey.
That year after dinner, while others did the dishes and after most of the leftover meat had been carved off the carcass, I double-bagged what was left of the turkey, placed it with the other trash by the back door, and reset the table for dessert. Later that night, I found both bags chewed through and the carcass picked clean. It only took following a short trail of greasy paw prints to find Lily under the kitchen table, engorged to nearly twice her normal size. She looked up at me, still licking her oily face.
Punish me if you must, but it was worth it.
When I finish telling the story to Lily, she laughs and says,
That was my favorite Thanksgiving.
It was not your favorite day after Thanksgiving. Lily thinks about this and delivers a flat,
Oh, yeah.
Ever since then, I've boiled the carcass for soup. Roasting the big one suggests cooking the bird breast side down for 1 hour at 425 degrees to crisp the skin and seal in the juices, before lowering the temperature to 325 degrees and flipping the bird breast side up until the turkey registers 165 on a meat thermometer. Overall, this should make the cooking time between 4 and 5 hours. The oven radiates a lot of heat on this already warm summer day, and Lily and I nap between bastings to escape from it. We don't have a lot of other Thanksgiving activities, so I play my DVD of Home for the Holidays, starring Holly Hunter. Halfway through the movie, I have to start peeling vegetables. I let the movie run for Lily while I get on with preparing the meal. Trent arrives around 5.
Wow, smells great in here. Did you make pumpkin bread?
No, I reply, annoyed. What with the turkey, the stuffing, the potatoes, the squash, the gravy, and the green beans, I didn't have time to make pumpkin bread.
It's not really Thanksgiving without pumpkin bread,
Trent pouts.
It's not really Thanksgiving at all.
Trent uncovers the pot containing the mashed potatoes and sticks his finger in. He scoops up a mouthful with his index finger and tells me they need more butter.
What else am I tasting?
In the potatoes? He nods. Nutmeg. It's my secret ingredient. Trent goes to the fridge and grabs himself a beer.
Can I see the octopus?
Lily's in the living room, but hey. I grab Trent by the elbow. Let's not mention him again tonight. I follow Trent because he's my best friend, and I know his reaction will tell me everything I need to know. He will cut through the bullshit and give it to me straight. Lily is asleep, octopus side up, giving us both a good view.
Oh, God.
His reaction confirms what I already know, that this is a big fucking deal, and there's no messing around.
Have you made a decision about what you're going to do?
I've decided not to talk about it on Thanksgiving. When it's time to sit down at the table, I produce 3 hats I purchased from a store that sells old movie costumes. 2 tall pilgrim hats for Trent and myself, each with a smart buckle, and a pilgrim bonnet with chin straps for Lily.
What movie these were from, I have no idea.
Trent balks at wearing his hat, but I say, without room for negotiation, put it on.
When I affix Lily's hat, the octopus, who has been eyeing the day's activities with suspicion, says,
"What are you doing? I might like turkey, or tofurkey."
He rolls the one eye I can see. "Unfortunately, you're not invited." I place the bonnet on Lily, covering the octopus completely. For once, she doesn't protest the idea of wearing something. I lift her up to the chair and set her on a pillow that boosts her up to proper table height. Let's begin by saying what we are thankful for while I carve the turkey.
"Tofurkey,"
Lily corrects incorrectly. The turkey looks so beautiful that I almost don't want to carve it. It seems golden and crisp and juicy and delicious. Whoever wrote "Roasting the Big One" knew what they were talking about. But once I make the first cut to slice off a drumstick, the smell that fills the room produces such hunger pangs that I realize I haven't eaten all day. It's hard not to just tear into the thing with my teeth. Trent starts. Despite the lack of pumpkin bread and his having to wear a hat, he's getting into the spirit of the whole thing.
"I'm thankful for Matt and for Wheezy," he begins, listing his boyfriend and his bulldog. "I'm thankful for good friends, of course."
He raises his glass to Lily and me. "And for good food, continued success, and togetherness. And the Dallas Cowboys." I'm suddenly aware that the sounds of football and parades are missing from our makeshift holiday. "Lily, how about you?"
"I'm thankful for tofurkey!"
"What else?" I ask.
"That's all! Tofurkey! Me!"
She licks her chops. "Okay, I'll go." I slide a few slices of turkey into Lily's supper dish, and a few more onto Trent's plate and mine. I, too, am thankful for friends, and for tofurkey, and for leftover tofurkey sandwiches, and the adventure of Thanksgiving in June. I'm thankful for my family. My sister Meredith called to say I'm going to be an uncle again, and I love being an uncle.
"Congratulations," Trent says.
I hold up a finger to say I'm not done. But most of all, I am thankful for Lily, who, since she entered my life, has taught me everything I know about patience and kindness and meeting adversity with quiet dignity and grace. No one makes me laugh harder or want to hug them tighter. You have truly lived up to the promise of man's best friend. Trent throws his fork at me because he doesn't like the idea of anyone but himself being called my best friend. But I toss the fork back, asking him to think in a larger context. Lily looks at me in annoyance, her shade made even cuter by her pilgrim bonnet. All this praise is just delaying our meal. I finish plating, or bowling, in Lily's case, our meals, and drizzle our food with gravy. Between Trent and Lily, it's hard to say who digs into the food more ferociously. I don't touch mine. Instead, I watch Lily consume every bite, observing the strange faces she makes as she drags her bonnet straps through the gravy and then desperately tries to lick them once there is no more food in her bowl. Damn it, Jenny. I am in mourning. That much is clear to me now. There is a recognizable departure from the normal attitudes of life. An 18-pound turkey is an acceptable meal for three. A dog's supper dish can be on the people table. Pilgrim hats are appropriate haberdashery in June. An octopus may take my dog. There may not be a November. Monday. The day after our impromptu Thanksgiving, it's mid-afternoon before it occurs to me that it's not Black Friday. It's not even Friday at all. It's Monday. But I'm already at the Grove, wandering the sidewalks of the outdoor shopping mall aimlessly in search of a good sale. I pass a number of stores that usually interest me, but my mind is somewhere else. With every good memory comes the memory of a mistake. A parallel memory. A darker recollection. The memory of Lily as a puppy transporting all my shoes to the top of the stairs. calls up a terrifying incident of her falling down those stairs because I hadn't had the foresight to block them with a gate. The triumph of expressing her bladder after surgery ushers in another flashback. When I was frustrated that she wouldn't pee and I yanked her leash so hard she squealed in pain. The memories of our longest talks couple with those of our longest silences. Either when we were mad or when we weren't. When maybe we just presumed the other was mad and we never bothered to ask if it was true. If I remember all of the good things, isn't it my responsibility to also remember the bad? If I remember the consumption of happiness at Thanksgiving, shouldn't I also remember the downing of poison, the force feeding of hydrogen peroxide? If I can feel her heartbeat through her chest as she sleeps nights snuggled next to me, shouldn't I also hear the gasping for breath when that same peroxide went down wrong? The bookends of these memories join to create a vice. My head is stuck between the movable jaws, which also act as giant conch shells to create the white noise of the ocean, as someone cranking the vice handle makes everything tighter and louder and more unbearable, until I struggle to remember why I'm even here. A sail, yes. But a sail on what? What am I shopping for? I search vainly for my bearings in a place that is not that big, not that overwhelming, and not at all unfamiliar. A trolley of tourists passes by with its deafening clang, a sound simultaneously muffled and piercing. I think of the trolley bench in the veterinarian's waiting room. Does the trolley make its last stop there? People exit shops like they're coming right at me. A man walks two dachshunds on leashes. They cut through the crowds, laser-focused. Just as they pass me, I start to dry heave. Everything is a blur, and the only thing that registers in my brain is that I've got to get out. My car is on the sixth level of a parking garage that I suddenly feel incapable of navigating. Escaping it would require a tight series of right turns down a central vertigo-inducing ramp that would be the end of whatever shreds of equilibrium I have left. Never mind driving home. I stagger past two restaurants, both so unappealing and bland that even on my best days I wonder who dines in them. I know these restaurants mark the exit from the mall, the way to the garage, but I can't bring myself to walk the narrow path between them. My brain fills with thoughts of the man who jumped off the roof of the parking garage and landed with a splat at the base of the escalator some months ago. Not thoughts about the man, exactly. I know nothing about the man except what they reported on the news. But of death. Of bones crunching. Of finality. Of strangulation. Of the octopus. I stumble forward, knowing this commits me to another lap around the eastern end of the mall. Out of the corner of my eye, a sign registers announcing a J. Crew men's store that is coming soon. I think to myself that I would like that, if I ever get out of here alive. If I ever have the nerve to come back. Somehow a table presents itself near the grassy area where they erect the skyscraper-like Christmas tree each November, the one that would be here now if it were actually Black Friday. I slump into a chair and put my head down. The tabletop is sticky, but I don't care. I don't even know who this table belongs to. I'm probably supposed to purchase a Haagen-Dazs ice cream or a Wetzel's soft pretzel to sit here. And maybe I will, but for now, I just need the spinning to stop. I need thoughts that don't squeeze me. I need good feelings that don't bring bad ones. I need the deafening roar in the conch shells to subside. I need to not be rankled by self-doubt. My head continues pounding, and the air is thick, like trying to breathe custard. I've sweated through my shirt. It sticks to my back like saran wrap. I think of pills, little candies of pleasure and relief. I can't remember if I have any at home. Goddamn Jenny, not prescribing me more. I try to imagine the calming whoosh of a Valium. The mounting clumsiness as the brain's messages are transmitted more slowly. The calming happiness. The warming embrace. Maybe I can will myself into a more placid state just with the idea, the memory of pills. A piece of fuzz lands near my feet. Then another. I wonder if it's snowing. Not actually snowing. It never snows in Los Angeles,
Except at the Grove, at Christmas time, when they launch fake snow from the roof of the movie theater with these cannon-like machines. Have two flakes coasted on a gentle breeze for 6 months, only now coming in for a landing? No. A mother chases a toddler blowing dandelion fluff. I should have known. Nothing floats effortlessly in limbo. Not for 6 months. From underneath my armpit, I can see the dachshunds pass by again. I can just see their little feet, their short legs. 8 of them in total, like the octopuses. But they move at such speeds, they look like more. Like million-legged millipedes out for an afternoon stroll. Seeing how they deftly maneuver around huge obstacles and through loud noises, coupled with the idea of pills, slowly brings me some calm. Lily would never tolerate the Grove. Not anymore. Not in old age. She would not have the wherewithal to navigate such a crowd. She would cower with her head down until I found a safe place for us to sit. She would be like me now, helpless, spinning, afraid. As Lily aged and her reactions slowed and her eyesight became less crisp, Doogie's predecessor warned me that she might develop something he called enclosed world syndrome. I told him I hadn't heard of enclosed world syndrome, only new world syndrome, the introduction of a modern, sedentary lifestyle to indigenous peoples along with obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. You're welcome, Native Americans. I don't know if enclosed world syndrome is an official syndrome or something this vet made up, or who is even in charge of anointing syndromes officially. But Lily did rather quickly come to find comfort only in smaller and smaller concentric circles, with our house at the center and, coincidentally, so did I. Or maybe Lily's aging coincided with the end of my relationship with Jeffrey and the stalling of my writing career. How's Jeffrey? How's the writing going? These were questions that had irritated me to my core. Not because of their illegitimacy, but because I had no response. How was Jeffrey? We can't go 2 days without fighting. How was the writing? I haven't written anything in months. It became easier to avoid people than to have to explain that I was struggling. My enclosed world syndrome got a little better, partly out of necessity, when I became single again. Lily's never did. Since the arrival of the octopus, I find myself spinning a familiar cocoon. It's impossible to talk about what I can't bring myself to say. If I were to join friends at a noisy bar or in a crowded restaurant and anyone were to ask, "How's Lily?" what on earth would I say? Well, there's an octopus on her head.
There's an ostrich in her bed?
Any conversation would only unravel from there. Slowly I lift my head and take in my surroundings. There's a shirtless model outside of Abercrombie and Fitch. Nordstrom is undergoing some sort of storefront remodel. Crate and Barrel is pushing patio umbrellas in bold, striped fabrics. Someone who may or may not be Mark Ruffalo is making a beeline toward Kiehl's. Slowly, the pounding in my head stops. Slowly, my body temperature lowers. My normal heartbeat returns. I wish there was a way I could see from my phone if the octopus was gone. Some sort of app connected to a series of nanny cams to spy on every room in my house. Something that would allow me to look at Lily asleep in her bed, her head unencumbered by that beast, her mind deep in the sweetest dream. Or maybe I'm glad that there's not. Maybe it would just be one more thing on my phone for me to check obsessively, taking me out of the moment, taking me away from life. Maybe I would use it as permission to stay clear of Lily and my magical thinking that that's when the octopus will leave, even though I know deep down it's going to take a lot more than a trip to the mall for him to go. When I get home, the octopus is still there. My heart sinks, despite my brain telling it not to. I saddle Lily in her harness and grab her leash, and we head out on a walk. Our old walk, the one up the quieter street with the hill. The one we used to take daily before our syndrome made us hermits, and our outdoor excursions became limited to the shorter route that looped us quickly back home. As we walk 2 blocks and round the corner,
and climb the hill that gives us a distant view of the Hollywood sign, Lily catches the scent of something on the grass between the sidewalk and the street. I let her sniff. There will be no yanking her by the neck. She can have all the time in the world. And I will forgive myself for the mistakes I've made. For the times I got so angry. For the times I've acted hatefully. The afternoon air is cool. The haze is soft. The last few petals of the jacaranda trees color the sidewalk. People are not yet home from work to walk their dogs. We don't get any strange looks or sideways glances. No one stops to ask why there's an octopus hitching a ride on my dog. In the distance, soft mountains and rolling hills mark the edge of the Los Angeles basin. There's the slightest hint of salt in the air. You'd have to really want to smell it, but it's there. Oh, look, the Hollywood sign. It's the octopus. Lily has finished sniffing and has turned to look back at me. I roll my eyes. It's smaller than I imagined. You're smaller than I imagined. It's not much of a comeback, and I'm not even sure what I mean by it, but it's all I have. Smaller as in petty, I guess. For the briefest moment, I think maybe the octopus just wants to see some sights. The Hollywood sign. Grauman's Chinese Theater. Venice Beach. The building where they filmed Die Hard. That maybe he mistook Lily for a small four-legged tour bus, and he's riding up top on a double-decker waiting for the next photo op. But I know this isn't true. Still, it's important for us to get out more, I think, while looking out at the expanse. Not so the octopus can leave, but because maybe the octopus is here to stay. Wednesday night. I wake to find the bed shaking and immediately think it's an earthquake. We haven't had one, a memorable one, for years, and in the back of my mind I've been preparing, expecting, waiting. I prop myself up on my elbows and stare into the darkness. Something's different. Something's not right. There's not the usual rolling sensation of surfing tectonic waves. My stomach isn't sinking in the way it does when you reach the top of a roller coaster. In the split seconds before the first drop. There isn't the usual calmness that overtakes me, the antithesis of how you think you'd react in an earthquake. The ability to think where flashlight batteries are, to count the ounces of bottled drinking water in the house, to remember how a transistor radio works, to wonder if you're wearing something acceptably dignified for when your body is found. I place my hand on Lily, and the source of this seismic activity becomes clear. She is in the throes of another seizure. I roll onto my side and pull her tightly to my chest. My lips are right behind her ear, behind the octopus, and I whisper angrily, "Let go of her. Let go of her. Let go." And then to Lily, "I've got you. I'm here. Shh." My mind drifts and I think of us in a tented war hospital, somewhere not far from the battlefield. The air is hot and thick. And Lily, the wounded veteran, is shaking in a morphine haze, deep in jarring flashbacks of the horrific events of war. I am the loving nurse, trying to calm the soldier, telling her to ignore the blasts of distant shells, ignore the moans of her fellow wounded, ignore the stench of charred flesh and destroyed lives, ignore the cawing of spiteful magpies singing gleefully of impending death, all while calmly wiping her forehead. Lily continues to convulse with her eyes rolled back, and my terror metastasizes into helplessness, paralysis, as I wait for the convulsions to stop. I hold my hand under her chin to keep her from thrashing her neck. It occurs to me that she may bite involuntarily or out of fear, but I don't care. Let her bite me. I would welcome the pain. I would rather something awake me from my utter uselessness. My tears start as I begin to feel like the octopus is squeezing my own head, his eight arms suctioned to my skin, compressing like the vice of my panic attacks. I almost remove my hand from under Lily's jaw to see if the octopus has not in fact jumped from her head to mine. Almost. Because I know he hasn't. I can see him still.
his tentacles gripped firmly around her.
As the shaking slows, I'm aware of a growing warmness underneath me, a wetness that spreads like a drop of food coloring and water. The warmth quickly cools. Lily has wet the bed, and her urine seeps across the sheets. I don't try to remove either of us from the puddle until the seizure fully subsides. And even then, we lie there, unwavering as my alarm clock ticks off several more minutes. I think of all the nights when Lily failed to pee on our bedtime walks, how much stress this would cause me, how difficult it was on those nights to fall asleep, to stay asleep, frustrated that I might have to take her to the yard in the darkness of pre-dawn. So many arguments this caused between us. I always thought I knew better when it came to her needing to pee, but until this night, she had never once actually wet the bed. And now that she has, we just lie there in the accident, and the minutes of the clock keep changing. And the love I have for her keeps growing. And we both keep drawing breath. What was so horrible about it? Why had I always been so angry? What was with my need to be right? To win every argument with her? To out-stubborn a dog? And just like that, all of the anger is gone. Released like the emptying of a bladder, into soft cotton sheets as we lie in the wetness. Lily tries to regulate her breathing, but it quickly turns to panting. Do you want water? You can drink mine. I indicate the glass of water I always keep on the nightstand. Lily shakes her head no. I'm so sorry, I say, for all those other nights.
Why?
The panting continues. And this makes me cry even harder. All those nights she had no idea that I went to bed angry at her, or if she had known, she has forgotten. Because dogs live in the present. Because dogs don't hold grudges. Because dogs let go of all of their anger, daily, hourly, and never let it fester. They absolve and forgive with each passing minute. Every turn of a corner is the opportunity for a clean slate. Every bounce of a ball brings joy and the promise of a fresh chase. She wants to know why I'm sorry. I don't want to tell her about my anger. I don't want to tarnish my image in her eyes. Not now. Not with the octopus listening. So when I respond, I lie. Because I'm going to have to give you a bath. A complete list of Lily's nicknames. Silly. Little. Lil. Monkey. Bunny. Bunny rabbit. Mouse. Tiny mouse. Goose. Silly goose. Mongoose. Monster. Monster.com. Peanut. Pinouche. Pinochle. Sweet pea. Walnut. Walnut brain. Copper bottom. Crazy. Baby. Puppy. Guppy. Old lady. Crank. Cranky. Cranky pants. Squeaky. Squeaky from. Tiger. Dingbat. Mush. Mushy face. Hipster. Slinkster. Slinky. Bean. Dog. Saturday. The sun rises with a surprising intensity, a sign that June gloom has cleared the runway and July is on approach. We're both tired, and it would have been easy to return to the bed after our morning walk, read from a book maybe, drift lazily in and out of sleep. But the sun beckons with a blazingly confrontational message. There is darkness, but there is also light. To stay in bed would be to embrace the darkness, the seizures, the octopus. To go outside is to embrace the light. How about we go somewhere? I suggest this as we eat breakfast. Kibble for her, kashi, per usual, for me.
Lily doesn't answer until she finishes her meal and sniffs around the kitchen floor to make sure no additional kibble has escaped the confines of her bowl.
I'm fine staying in.
I know you're fine with staying in, but I think we should take a ride and see the ocean. Lily thinks about this, and I wonder how much she remembers the ocean, if she misses it. We used to go there a lot. My hope is the octopus misses it, and will take one look at his home and crawl back into the sea. The car is warm from the morning sun, and I open the sunroof. Lily lasts about 30 seconds in the passenger seat before she climbs into her customary perch on my lap. She turns around 3 times, and I wait at a stop sign until she settles because it's hard to drive when your dog is stepping on sensitive bits that she shouldn't. As always, she quiets herself with her chin in the crook of my left elbow, and we turn down the street heading west. We hit the Pacific Coast Highway in no time. Where is everyone? It's almost like an entire city has been so lulled by the gloom and the haze that they've all given up their identity as early risers. Their loss, our gain. The sun is even shining as we emerge off the 10 and through the tunnel that gives us our first glimpse of the Pacific. This is a hard one to explain to visitors. The weather differential between most of Los Angeles and the ocean. The beach is often the last part of the city to see sun, but not today. Today, the sun sparkles majestically off the water. I stream some music from my phone and crank it loud, but this seems to bother Lily. She has the look of someone with a crippling hangover, the thumping bass going right through her. So I turn the volume down until you can just make out the music over the sound of the air that whooshes over and past the open sunroof. We pass a string of familiar landmarks. The restaurant where Jeffrey and I had our first date. Paradise Cove, where I had lunch with my father the last time he visited. Trancas Market, where in my 20s I used to buy bottled water and snacks before hitting a Malibu beach. I see a younger version of myself at each, and it's all I can do not to wave. I wonder what my younger selves would think of me now, if they would recognize me, or even care to wave back. We stop at El Matador, 10 miles or so north of Malibu, a beach that's always brought solace and a certain clear-headedness. There were days after I first moved to the city when I would grab a friend or two and a towel and sunscreen, and we'd go to this beach, and you'd have to drag me away under protest at sunset. Now, it always seems there's too much to do to indulge in whole days of such leisure. But that's probably just an excuse. What is there to do, really? Despite the early hour, there are only 3 open spots in the tiny parking lot, and I grab one of them. The rest are taken by surfers, no doubt, their internal clocks align with the tides. The lot sits maybe 150 feet up on a cliff above the beach, and the views from the parking lot alone are spectacular. You can easily see the other pocket beaches, El Pescador, the fisherman, and La Piedra, the rock. I've wondered why El Matador is thusly named, the bullfighter. Perhaps it's the craggy stone formations that emerge from the sea. But they are less like bulls to me than sea monsters, like the octopus. El Pulpo, as a name, is probably less inviting. Lily and I get out of the car and stroll a bit to the cliff's edge. I pick her up, and we survey the horizon together. So, do you remember the beach?
Is this the beach?
She asks. Yes, yes, down below, it is. Lily looks down.
I remember.
Then, tentatively,
are we going down there?
Not today. Dogs aren't allowed on this beach. There's a sign that says as much. But I think about breaking the rules. What is anyone going to do? Call a park ranger? The police? But Lily looks content, and there's a picnic table that's not being used, so I decide not to ruffle any feathers. I thought we could just sit here for a while. Lily agrees, and we sit on the table and listen to the ocean, to the sound of the pounding surf that, because it is so far below, sounds farther away than it is. The muffled cackle of people laughing in the water and the distant cries of soaring gulls add layers to the symphony. We have some decisions to make, monkey. Lily mulls the weight of this for a moment before asking,
why do you call me that?
Why do I call you what?
Monkey.
Why do I call you Monkey?
And all those other names.
Those are terms of endearment.
I don't understand.
Lily squints as she stares out into the sun. Terms of endearment are names or phrases that you use to address someone that you feel great affection for. The wind picks up and we sit quietly for a moment.
You have a lot of them for me,
she observes. That's because I have a lot of affection for you. And then, almost as an afterthought, do you have any terms of endearment for me? Lily thinks about this.
Mostly, I think of you as that guy.
I could let that bother me, but I don't. Terms of endearment are probably a human thing. They're certainly not a dog creation. They have other things, tail wagging, for instance, instead. To her, I am that guy. The guy. Her guy. In the water, a pod of dolphins breaks the surface, and we watch them as they dive up and down over the forming waves. Part of me wishes we were not high on a cliff. Part of me wishes I could swim out to the dolphins and enlist their help in prying the octopus from Lily with their bottle noses and returning him to the ocean depths. Can the octopus hear us now? I ask.
No.
You can tell.
Sometimes. He gets bored with us a lot and tunes out.
If he's so bored, then he should leave. I scratch the back of Lily's neck while trying to choke down my offense. Bored with us? Really? He's not exactly a master of witticisms and repartee. Who the hell does he think he is? Lily does this thing where she lifts her snout in the air, and I can tell that the back rub feels good, so I continue. I'm more comfortable snuggling with her when I know the octopus isn't going to interfere.
We have some decisions to make, Goose.
Hard ones. About how to get rid of... Instead of saying the octopus, I point at it. I don't want his curiosity piqued by his mention. And, to be blunt about it, all of the options suck. I continue stroking Lily's back. I'm not sure how much of this she grasps. Sucks for the octopus. Sucks for her. Sucks for us. I think of what Doogie has told me, as well as what I've read in my own research. Although my own research is limited. If you Google octopus on dogs, most results you get are about making an octopus out of a hot dog by cutting the bottom two-thirds the long way into 8 sections to look like arms and leaving the head of the hot dog intact. Apparently, the Japanese add these to bento-type lunchboxes for children. This makes me think less of the Japanese. There's surgery where they'll try to cut them off. That's perhaps the most obvious thing to do. But the doctors won't know if they can get all of him until they put you under and see what kind of grip he holds. Lily looks confused, so I remind her. You had surgery once on your spine. Lily recoils, and I feel her tremble.
I don't like surgery.
I don't think anyone does. Maybe only surgeons.
What else?
Her reaction confirms what I already know, but surgery, in many ways, would be the most satisfying. The idea of stabbing a scalpel into the octopus and starting to cut is so appealing, I almost want to do it myself, to bring about his demise at the violent end of a knife. But there's no way for even the most decorated surgeon to do this without also stabbing a knife into Lily. Neither of us can abide by this, if it's even a worthwhile option at all. There's chemotherapy and radiation.
What do those things do?
They would try to shrink the him, I suppose. It's a funny visual, like a cartoon. The octopus getting smaller and smaller in front of our eyes until he has only a high, squeaky voice and croaks something along the lines of,
I'm melting,
like the Wicked Witch of the West.
Do those hurt like surgery?
I try to imagine putting Lily through either. What they would both do to her already subdued spirit.
her voice would be lost. I can't imagine ever hearing her exclaim,
I just came back from chemotherapy, and it was so much fun! Let's all stick peanut butter to the roofs of our mouths and lick frantically until it's gone!
I can't imagine ever hearing her exclaim anything like that. Neither is pleasant, I say.
Next,
she says dismissively. They can put you on steroids to try to reduce the octopus that way, reduce the swelling he's causing on your brain, and start you on anticonvulsants to lessen the frequency of seizures. But those do a lot of damage to your kidneys. Lily has already had several courses of steroids on occasions when swelling returned to her spine. I used to find the idea of her on steroids funny, that I might come home and find a dachshund-shaped hole on the wall, and half the cars in the block overturned in a Hulk-like rage. But only funny because I was so scared. I needed to think of the steroids as superhuman, super canine. There could be no surgery for her again on her spine. The steroids had to be powerful. They had to work.
Harumph!
Lily scoffs, summing up her feelings on all the choices. She's not going to help me make this decision. She's a dog and has other concerns. And what about any of this can she really understand? Or maybe she's made her decision, and what I need to do is listen. Maybe she knows what the vet says, what may seem obvious to anyone who thinks about it, that there is no true cure for canine octopus. Not any that has been discovered yet. Lily stands on my lap and raises one of her front paws in her best guard dog stance.
Look! The dolphins are back and they're jumping! I want to jump in the waves like that!
I look up and the pod has returned. And sure enough, they are jumping and twisting and flipping and flopping playfully in the rising tide. And yet, even more enchanting is Lily's voice. The one I can't bear to dim or silence. It's older, and her exclamations are fewer and farther between. Her puppyish enthusiasm is gone. But it is still her voice. It is still her. You don't like to get wet, I say.
Oh, yeah,
Lily says. She settles back down in my lap. It's a fun idea, though, Mouse, splashing in the waves. After a pause, Lily looks up at me.
Sometimes I think of you as Dad.
My heart rises in my throat. That's the only term of endearment I need.
Ink. 1.
It's late, past the time I usually go searching for Lily to bring her to bed. Except tonight, I don't have to search for her, because she's creating such a ruckus in the hallway, barking and growling and carrying on. When I catch up to her, she's staring into the corner between the bedroom and bathroom doors, in her offensive low crouch, hackles raised, clearly startled and upset.
Goose?
Goose!
Mongoose, what is it?
She doesn't miss a beat or move to back down or acknowledge my presence in any way. She just barks at the damn corner like it's an advancing battalion. I'm already leaning down to grab her, when she stops me cold in my tracks.
This llama, beach ball, 7, parliament, casserole, Antarctica, pajamas!
What the... We both stare at each other, frozen. It's like being in a horror film when someone starts speaking in tongues, and the whole room falls silent. I'm almost waiting for Lily's head to rotate like an owl's and for her to start vomiting pea soup. But I know for a fact she's not possessed by demons. Just one demon. A squishy, 8-tentacled prick. I scoop her up and squeeze her tight to soothe her, but she wriggles left, then right, then nearly out of my grip altogether. It takes a moment pressed against my chest for her to snap out of whatever trance she's in. And when she does, she begins to shake uncontrollably in my arms. Guppy, what was that?
Lily turns from me to the light, then from the light to the dining room, then from the dining room to the bedroom.
I can't see,
she says. This startles me. Can't see what? I turn on the light, hoping it will help.